Welcome to the third installment of the Polycast side series Evergreen. I'm Wouter Locutus Snyders. The show's third season saw Annalie Cartamendo-Abani depart as the fourth regular co-host and be replaced by Philip the Me and Team Bellow, and he's still on the panel as of season 10. In addition to 26 episodes and a special, Revcast, the third Polycast spin-off, was launched that year. As with the previous two Evergreens, Polycast regular co-host Daniel Dan Q Quick selected and ranked the 10 topics he feels most retained their relevance years after they were first published. Further, recurring guest co-host Canis Albinus re-listened to the entire season to select the 10 most representative moments for the show, including yet another two honorable mentions. For this next generation of Polycast countdowns, I could apologize, but I won't. Now, listen carefully or you may miss the subliminal messaging throughout. Number 10, from episode 63, Lingo Lowdown Goes a Long Way.
Commonly used acronyms in the Civ community.
DL.
Back on January 28th of 2006, so this thread even predates Polycast. Wow, it's old. CFC site administrator Thunderfall wrote, "As you know, we have a Civ acronyms page that lists some of the commonly used acronyms in the Civ community. Feel free to suggest acronyms to add to the list." I looked at the page, which of course has been updated since he made that post.
Oh wait, is there a top 10 coming?
Actually, no, there's not. I think one of the most commonly used ones is BFC, Big Fat Cross, a city's workable 21 tiles. On Polycast, whenever we're going to use an acronym, we try to remember to explain what the acronym is, but sometimes we do forget. We often talk about, or at least I do, GPT, gold per turn. And then, of course, there's some other people here that talk about, you know, like CPT, culture per turn. And I thought, yeah, that's true. You could use that acronym, but I really don't ever remember seeing CPT anywhere or ever using that myself. I don't know about other people. Or I don't talk about HPT, hammers per turn, either. You could use it, but I just don't think it's commonly used.
I don't think I've heard it that much.
I've seen it used in threads, but then again, I've never had a Civ conversation with anyone before in my life, so I've never heard any of the stuff used in conversation before.
Now you have.
Yes, I have.
Was there an acronym for Great Profit? Because in the beginning, when I was relatively new to the game, I always thought GP was Great Profit, and then I realized it was Great People, and I was like, oh.
They use both of them, actually. Some people use it. You're going to have to read for context with that. It's like GA being used for Golden Age and Great Artists. You have to read for context.
Yes. OB for Open Borders. I talk about Open Borders, but I don't remember ever actually saying OB, hardly at all. SOD, Stack of Doom. Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
Favorite acronym ever.
BFC, GPT, SOD, and then UB and UU, absolutely used a lot. Unique building and unique units, respectively, Civ specific.
See, I use SOWA, SOWA, for stack of whoop ass.
Nice.
There's a good one over here on January 28th of 2006. Tavernier had it. It's my ass, I at ham. It says, "Man, I am screwed. Isabella and Tokugawa are my neighbors."
I've played that game far too many times.
War weariness, WW. I have never referred to war weariness as WW.
I don't think I've ever heard that one either. Yeah, doesn't it stand for Wonder Woman?
Bushface says, CPU, combat probabilities unreliable. Yeah, that happens from time to time.
Number 9, from episode 70, get meta and considering which came first, the sword or the shield.
From Beeblebrox, I asked this rhetorical question, obviously. However, in Civ, it seems this is not the case. It is perfectly possible to discover and build anti-tank units long before anyone in the world even knows what a tank is. Likewise, grenadiers may be built with their advantages against riflemen many techs before knowing what a red coat looks like. Again, I rhetorically ask why. The simple answer is the Civ is too easy mob, pointing out that mechanized armies historically have repeatedly triumphed in nation-versus-nation conflicts isn't good enough explanation for these people. It may be an easy tactic on lower levels for a large number of people, but please remember that quite a significant portion of people will never advance beyond noble difficulty because, much as I hate to blow sunshine up some people's backsides, Civ is a hard game such that many people will never see the likes of Monarch, Emperor difficulties because the time and investment to get that good is too large for them. So to leave a couple of tactics in that are obvious to a select elite, is this really such a bad thing? Is Civ meant to pander to a clique of people of thousands, if that? I would say not. We like the idea of going through history, matching, echoing, reenacting the trials and tribulations of history. That's real life, actual life history, note the capital H. Unquote.
Yeah, this thread stirred up a whole hornet's nest of issues.
Was it all the elite people coming out and going, hey, hey?
Yeah, Beeble Brox, you had some point in there, but unfortunately it's not just what you said, but it's how you said it. That not that I agree with what you're saying otherwise, but wow, that was not the way to go about it. I think kind of the short response is from Aftershafter, this game has settings for everyone, quote-unquote. But he also says, you know, I don't get what you want. Do you want all difficulties to be easily accessible to all gamers? Isn't the entire purpose of difficulties to make some levels of play inaccessible to those who aren't willing to sink a great deal of time and thought into playing a game? This game is made in a manner that allows for many levels of play. I concur with that. If you never get above noble difficulty and you're happy with that, that's great. If you are not satisfied with noble difficulty and you're sufficiently not satisfied with noble difficulty in it being too easy for you, that you are going to continue to move up the difficulty levels and invest that time, then that's great. We don't have to agree on that. It caters to a number of different types of players, not just warmongers and builders, but also people who have different time commitment availabilities, whether that's constantly or you were available quite a bit and then you weren't able to play the game for a while and you want to get back into it. You just don't have a little time so you can scale down the difficulty level. All of these kind of mix and matching is perfectly fine with me. I really don't see an issue or a problem here.
Yeah, like a newbie Civ gamer come onto the boards frustrated about certain things, but I've never really heard any sort of sense that, oh no, I'm only playing at noble. What's wrong with me? This game is making me feel inferior. You just don't get a sense of what the rankings mean, if anything, until you actually spend a lot of time in the forums and get a sense of how the community plays and importance that is attached to that by some people. Otherwise, it's not a big deal.
I was able to relate more closely with Pie Master simply because, if for no other reason, then he mentions playing on the level that I play on now, which is Prince. I play on Prince and find that quite hard. Very occasionally I win, sometimes I'm involved in good games but ultimately lose, and other times I just get blown out of the water. But how does the existence of the deity and immortal levels hurt me in any way? It wouldn't even matter if there were 15 higher difficulty levels than Prince. I'm never going to see them. Big deal, quote-unquote, and I feel exactly the same way.
Me three.
Beeble Brox replied to that in particular and said, and you are content with that. In that respect, I believe you are unusual. Leaving the majority of players firmly fixed at the level below average will, in my opinion, harm Civ in the long run, quote unquote.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Because all of you suck, you're going to bring down Civ's overall quality? No, that hasn't been true through the whole... How many years now? 20 years almost this has been around?
Yeah. Wow. Think about it for a moment, Beeble Brox. Let's say you buy anything. You buy a particular product, whether it's an appliance, you buy some food, you buy a computer, whatever it happens to be. Are you more likely to be vocal if you are satisfied or dissatisfied? Based on the experience not only on Civ Fanatics, but Politan and the new We Play Civ over the weeks, months, years, just as what Zyder was saying, and Mackie as well, these must be quite the silent majority, and they must be muffling themselves with their hand and their face getting all red and biting their tongue to the point that it's almost bitten off, because if people really felt that way, I think the boards would be full of people cursing the game left, right, and center.
To go back to your appliance analogy, it's like saying if I don't always separate my whites and my darks, I'm bringing down the quality of washers everywhere. Come on. They are not going to dumb it down just because everyone doesn't play at that level. The fact that they've added so many more difficult levels, when it used to be there was only 5 difficulty levels in Civ 1, they've added more difficulty levels to cater to the very people who want to play that hard, but they've left all the lower levels intact for those of us that don't have the time to get quite that micromanagey good.
And these games are so largely individual. I don't think the multiplayer will ever be the majority of the games that happen. People don't have to always play multiplayer. However, that means that everybody's playing on an individual effort. Nobody cares what level I play on. Nobody cares what I'm doing, if I win or not. I don't understand this whole thing that the Civ community will crumble because I am not playing on deity level every time I play. And calling me below average makes me feel really bad and want to punch him.
Get in line, sister.
At one point in the thread, Napalm102, who hadn't said anything at that point, had said, well, after reading the whole thing, here's my take. For a game, balance is more important than realism or historical accuracy. Keep in mind that once you have played through the game once, you basically have foreknowledge of what is to come when you play next. Just the fact that you can see your tech tree and plan what discovery is going to come next, and you can pretty much throw the whole real history argument out the window. And then the difficulty of the game is a fine balance. Make it too hard and nobody plays. Make it too easy and people get bored. So find your own niche and play there and leave the higher difficulty levels to those who are prepared to invest time needed to learn the game, quote unquote. I don't know if I'd say to learn the game, but invest the time needed to
master those higher levels.
Yes. Get into the real nooks and crannies and get into the some real micromanagement.
Yeah, the spreadsheets and the crazy stuff like that.
I usually side with historical accuracy, but usually that's because of pragmatism. Like, it makes sense to have this discovery come after this discovery, etc., and practicality and things like that. I don't think that historical accuracy is more important than game balance, because otherwise, what is the point? And I enjoy the aspect of game balance that we have, whether or not everything is historically accurate or not. I think the pieces that we can play with, like my husband likes to do with like outfits and leader heads that are not necessarily will play into game balance but make it more historically accurate, those are the things that we like to play with.
If you wanted something a little more, well, not really historical, but you know, he's talking about how once you play the game, once you can path through the tech tree. Well, if maybe in Civ 5 they threw in a blind research option like Alpha Centauri, where you can only determine the general direction and not exactly what, like early on, say, I want military techs, and that would lead you, say, towards bronze working and iron working, or I want cultural techs, that would lead you towards the religious techs or something like that.
More of a natural progression.
Yes.
And I think a lot of times, speaking for the historical people, it's not that we want it historically accurate. We always want to play the game just like history happened. We like to rewrite history. We're starting over. We're making it the way we wanted it to be.
Yeah, with the general direction, like in Alpha Centauri, it's kind of like going into Civ 4 and telling the governor, concentrate on science. So I'm not telling you later on in the game, for instance, build a library here and build a research lab, so on and so forth. Just concentrate on that, just that kind of general direction. And if you want something in between knowing the tech tree in Civ 4 and that, in Galactic Civilizations 2, depending upon which civilization you choose, for instance, your technology tree is different. I'm not saying necessarily this would work for Civ proper, but it certainly could be perhaps a mod that, oh, I played with this civilization and that tech tree had some overlap, but there were definitely some things that I could research that other Civs could not research. And I think that's not just based on your civilization, but also your alignment, your moral alignment, whether you're kind of good, bad, or in between. Although we kind of have that in sort of a way now. Not quite the same technological progression. We know the technology tree, but thanks to unique units and unique buildings, it's not simply, well, my gameplay in all the same settings, if I chose the Americans or the Romans, it's going to be the same. It can be different because, hey, Romans, Iron, Praetorians. In any event, Beeblebrox, I suspect you have high blood pressure and may want to consult a doctor. Or at least try some deep breathing.
You say he should research meditation?
Number 8 from episode 74. Playing Civilization Helping Your Career? A Consideration Eternal.
It'll give you a relaxing time away from your career. That's what it does for me. A chance to unwind.
I recall an interesting study that was released, it was a couple of years ago, around 3 or 4 years ago, and it was when all the hype was on about kids playing too much in the way of video games. And the study actually came to the conclusion that kids who were spending a lot of time in video games did better in school and actually did better in the workplace. Now, in the school, you could say whether it was just a question of pure intelligence, but in the workplace, they said what they'd come up with, they had better social interaction skills, better problem-solving skills, and these were the things that were directly applicable to a career. So it seems to me that that applied to some of the video games back then. It applies just as easily to Civ, if not more so.
I don't know. You go on World of Warcraft and social skills are really bad. But
Spore.
Some of the planning skills are even worse.
Yeah, but for Civ specifically, I think it's a good management tool, you know, how to manage all your workers, all your units. So that's a good way to keep track of things.
I'd say for me, it's a little bit more vice versa. My career as a manager has helped me more with Civ, you know, because I have to cover so many areas of my work, so, and supervise so many people and accountable for so many different aspects. So that has helped my career in Civ.
There was one person in the thread who said, Civ can definitely help your career. It's just that the odds of doing it are pretty low. Comment from John Schaefer. Well, okay, John.
Lies.
It's like, this question is not applicable for you.
I would say that Civ would probably hurt your career more often than help, because if you keep walking into work all tired, you probably won't get much done.
One more turn. Yeah.
Well, if you manage your time well.
One more turn.
Your boss says, hey, that report was due today at 3 o'clock. What's up with you? Hey, I was up all night conquering the world. Back off.
You don't have open borders, boss. Step out of my office.
Past Polycast guest co-host Rusty Edge said, I'm a retired insurance adjuster, and I think random events are way cool.
Yeah, I bet so. It's not covered. Sorry.
Obviously, if you're in the gaming industry or wanting to break into the gaming industry, playing Civ and modding Civilization can be really beneficial. As far as the content of Civilization, certainly not a lot of the specifics can really help, because there's a lot of abstraction there, and there's a lot of changes in gameplay, as should be the case, because, you know, it's supposed to be fun. I think just the actual practice, the strategy involved, if you're then able to, kind of what Beta was saying, you know, having the intelligence to be able to apply what you're doing in-game, and then applying it to your career, or even your personal life in general, and vary from person to person.
Yeah, I try to tell Mrs. Troll, I'm the ruler here. Of course, I get shot down and deposed.
Dream on.
Legion Steve perhaps had my favorite comment, which was, I think I use a lot of the same skills at work, manager, programmer, in a business software company, as I do when I'm playing Civ. Unfortunately, I can't use the same strategies. I don't have a trebuchet to fire people, though I often wish I did.
Number 7, from episode 66, an equal yet opposite counterpart for the Golden Age in Civ.
This thread about Dark Ages was just kind of like the opposite of Golden Ages, but not really opposite. It's kind of weird. His idea, he knows it would piss some people off. Can I say that, piss people off? Mm-hmm. I guess. My mother wouldn't like it, but... He wanted it to be like a message would pop up and say, a huge plague has hit your civilization, removing one plot from all cities and starting a 100-year dark age. The world is totally peaceful except for crazy people on it with no disasters, diseases, or droughts that would cause a dark age. And he thinks that's too unusual and we need to have this addition to the game. And I'm like, no, I don't think so, because that would mess up my beautiful world. But some people in the thread really liked it and thought it would be a great idea. But I don't like it. But then other people in the thread were like, yeah, actually, you should be able to do that. You should have great spies could be able to start dark ages in other civilizations.
Well,
I kind of like the idea, because that's generally how the plague, you know, in history was spread, through trading and other contact and warfare. And so I think it'd be interesting if some kind of contact caused the plague or spread it from one civ to another.
Yeah, and seeing as how for golden ages, except for a couple of wonders, you need great people, they would initiate it. So why not have a great person be able to initiate a dark age? Only in this case, you want your great person not to go to one of your cities.
Right.
I started a dark age in my own city. Damn it. Reload.
Oops. Oops.
And actually, the thread was 3 years old, and somebody necroed it. And my favorite was Rough Pie said, further, if you pop a great scientist in a dark age, the unit is deleted. And if you pop a great priest, you get another one automatically. Which I thought was hilarious, but some people might be offended by that. I don't know.
And with the great spy suggestion being able to start a dark age, it was suggested that, for instance, if you had a great scientist, it could stop a dark age.
And somebody was suggesting having other kinds of great people to start something like great heretics and heathens and rebels. People were going off on this idea.
If you're going to associate it with great people, just associate it with the great people that are already in the game.
Yeah.
As was suggested.
But it would be kind of funny to do it to the other guys. I just don't think I'd like it if it happened to me.
Well, 6K Man suggested that a dark age not be a Civ-specific something, but something that affected everybody.
Yeah.
That it wouldn't be game-breaking, but could have an effect on everyone on the game.
Hmm.
And so as a result, it wouldn't be a random event. Some people were like, well, no, that shouldn't just happen at random. It depends on some choices you make throughout the game. Generally, I like the idea that it affects everyone. Now, I can understand people saying, well, if you're talking about this being the opposite of a golden age, of course, a golden age doesn't happen to everybody. But gameplay versus realism, yes, in history there was the Dark Ages, but we have to think about gameplay. Is that really going to be fun? And I don't think it would be fun just to be a random event, because if we are going to call it a Dark Age random event, then it would need to be sufficiently bad enough to justify calling it a Dark Age, however we want to apply that in the game. I support those people who say that's comparable of taking away what a golden age would give you for a temporary period of time. But maybe if it is going to be Civ-specific in a game, maybe at some point everybody gets a dark age. Whether it's everybody gets a dark age at the same time, or whether people get a dark age at different periods of time. And of course that could be problematic, particularly the latter. Because your ability to address a dark age early on probably isn't going to be as well as your ability to deal with a dark age later on. The thing about having it so that with a dark age that there's a benefit to it, since we're talking about it being the opposite of a golden age, there really isn't a negative for a golden age, other than the fact that you've used a great person to start a golden age, for instance, rather than use it for some other purpose. And that's not really a direct negative. That's something you've got to take into account in the particular situation.
Yeah.
It sounds a bit complicated when you start saying, oh, the Dark Age would do this negative, but it would do this in terms of a positive.
Well, I like how Blitzkrieg says and ties in the link with the church, because the church really did take over in the form of what he calls a pseudo-empire during the Dark Ages, and they encouraged, in a way, the Dark Ages by refusing to spread education to the common people. So I think that's interesting that other things will decrease, the church, and whoever perhaps owns the church would flourish. I think that makes a lot of sense, historically speaking.
In some respects, you know, maybe that's something to consider instead of making a total random whatever. Because the main Dark Age that he's talking about, as people pointed out, was through Roman collapse, and Golden Ages are done because you've met certain criteria. They don't just pop out of the blue, necessarily. Maybe some criteria will have to be reached, or should be reached, and then you say, okay, we're going to put you in a Dark Age because of it. Like, you're sending out too many missionaries.
Shala Grimson even ties it into civics, suggesting every turn spent in theocracy should get a 5% chance of a civ going into a Dark Age, but give it a few advantages as well as disadvantages. If we were going to do that, then I would think then, okay, what civic would give you a 5% chance of going into a golden age? Do we really want to get into that kind of game balance issue? Do we really want to tie that into civics?
No, you'd have to balance it out with a pretty decent good thing. 5% chance of a dark age, what would balance it out necessarily? It seems more apt for a scenario.
Or a mod.
Yeah.
That would make it more interesting, more complex. A random event is really like, oh, you just lost all your gold, and then you can go on from there. It's a one-turn kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree. I don't think it should be a random event. But I think it could be large enough to justify perhaps a scenario or a mod as well.
I like what Flytire says, though. He's had his own dark age before in the game. He just didn't need the computer to tell him through.
Number 6, from episode 65. Rarely are new segments, as ever, even more relevant than the time this was recorded. The place of free-to-play games and their impact for civilization and games like it.
Designing for free, from Soren Johnson.
Which he doesn't mean he's going to design to for free for you.
Oh, no, no, no. It's on the lines of you pay to play. Even though you don't have to pay, what you're paying for, it actually improves your avatar, your character, in this game. Let me just read the opening paragraph from Soren Johnson. In China, the new MMORPG, entitled ZT Online, has gained significant popularity, with over 10 million users and an ARPU of $40 per month. Like many Asian games, ZT is free to play and focuses primarily on player versus player gameplay. You actually use real cash, real money, to improve your character within this gaming environment. CK1 posted a comment on this after the articles. I don't like games where you can buy in-game advantages. That's why I've stopped playing Travian. I happily pay the supporter subscription for Hatrick each year, especially because the money gives you mostly cosmetic things and a few statistics, and Hatrick can be played very well with just 1 or 2 hours per week.
I think it's a decent idea to have free and then be, hey, if you want to have more stuff, you can pay a subscriber fee. But if you don't, you can just play for free.
That's why we have Poly Plus.
There you go.
I like the idea of free-to-play, you know, and being able to have microtransactions in a game. I think it probably allows for a continuing source of revenue for developers. Personally, though, I shy away from it. Maybe it's my own personality type, but I wouldn't want to go down that road. I'd be spending all my money, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Apple now is even in the new OS for the iPhone, allowing for microtransactions, which is going to be curious how that happens on a 99-cent game. You know, what's the next transaction going to be, $10?
Hmm.
Well, exactly. I'm not a big fan of the idea myself, I must admit. Maybe I'm just a bit old-fashioned. I like to get a game and I like to play it. I don't like my playing to be limited depending on how much money I'm willing to cough up for that game. And it's a vicious cycle, potentially. I mean, once that's doing it, upping the odds, and it can get to be very expensive until we end up in a place we don't want to be with gaming. Especially because there were some posts have mentioned with applying it to Civ, for example.
Yeah.
Don't like the idea of that at all.
Yeah, and that's what this whole thing is about, is because he's, you know, designing for free. He's talking about designing for these games that are free to play, and you have the microtransactions, and that you have to find a balance between what you can get with the microtransactions and what you can do for free to play. And he mentions in there later in the article as Puzzle Pirates as being a good example of how to do it.
Mm-hmm.
There's people who have never put any money into the game at all, and yet they don't really have a disadvantage against the players who have put a lot of money in. Because most of the stuff that you use the doubloons, the microtransaction money for, not everything, but a lot of things are just cosmetic. Basic things that you need to do in the game to get ahead in the game are all free. So if you want the extra fancy shiny sword or something, you can have that.
And the other thing about Puzzle Pirates is items that you are able to purchase in-game often require both types of currency. The currency of money and then also the currency of time. This time spent actually playing the puzzle games. So with this dual currency system, what happens is, as Soren says, is there's a natural market dynamic keeping the two sides balanced, quote-unquote. So you got $1,000 to spend, and someone has spent 1,000 hours playing the game. You need each other in order to be able to buy those items. I like that balance between the two types of currency and also the type of items you can buy. Some are cosmetic, and some actually affect the gameplay. You mentioned Travian. You actually related it to Polton Plus, which is...
not really the same.
No, it's not the same, but it's comparable in the sense that a Polton Plus, not charging you for access to content.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to give you access to something that other people don't have. It's flavor. It's kind of like, okay, in the game, purchase this product so you can have shinier clothing. Yeah, it looks nicer, but it's not going to mean that you're going to be able to get farther along in the game, just like buying a Poulton Plus does not mean you're going to be able to post more, for instance.
Wait a second, why not?
You post enough already.
The interesting about Travian, which is a massive multiplayer online strategy game, not only does it offer access to better products, but it unlocks an improved interface to make playing the game more efficient. So it's not like, oh, you don't like the default style on a Poulton's forums? Well, buy Plus and you can have access to all of these different templates. I mean, that would be a comparable thing.
Actually, from what he says in there in the article, it's almost more like buy Poly Plus and we'll actually let you send a private, like a basic thing, because what it's talking about in there, his example is about a build queue. You can't even put a build queue in unless you buy the Plus thing. And that's just, ah.
Yeah.
See, crippling functionality for the sake of making more money doesn't seem like a good idea either. Wouldn't you hate it if every time you did something in Civ 4, you couldn't automate a worker to do certain things? You have to update it every single turn to continue something. It would just be immensely frustrating.
That's true, but I mean, on the other hand, one can see where it would be somewhat attractive to some people. It's like, well, I never do a build queue. If I can get it cheaper and not have to worry about that, oh, why not?
Yeah.
And some aspects, it is somewhat attractive, but I know totally what you're saying. It could be like the first few months about when Vista UAC controller, you know, it comes up every single time and you're like, oh, I gotta do this again. I gotta hit continue for doing this random thing. And of course, then pay for feature thing, it'd be like, oh, I gotta pay like an extra dollar now and then download this other thing so I could do this. And it might get annoying on the one level like that, but I guess it depends on pricing.
I think Soar knew that this was going to be on Polycast because to some degree addresses our initial response in that third paragraph where he talks about Westerners being a little bit appalled by this. But in Asia, where they're looking at a lot of piracy, that this is one attempt they've made to restrict it. I like that because it gives us a perspective on culture. And also I like that because of, I don't know if any of you guys read the book Tipping Point by Maxwell Gladwell, I think, or something like that. Where he talks about manipulating the environment to get the results you want, which is interesting for me to see things like this kind of taking place, even though they're diabolical.
One of the reasons why developers like MMORPGs is that, hey, you gotta pay every month, and if you want to play, you have to sign in with your person and log in. You can't really pirate it, necessarily. You can probably pirate the underlying disc or whatever, which is, what, $30, $40, but then you gotta pay the $10, $12 a month in order to play it, and you're gonna log onto a server every time you play the game and make sure that people don't pirate. And I think a lot of it seems like, especially as broadband usage increases, as a lot of games want to get involved with, hey, you got to log onto the internet every once in a while, just so we can see that you're not pirating games. And I think you're right. In the West, maybe some people are appalled by it because of privacy concerns.
Yes, I mean, I'm really opposed to that idea going that strongly in that direction, because for the game, I want to play it without having somebody snooping into what I'm doing all the time.
Tells you something about how good the Puzzle Pirates model works, because they have two servers that are the regular subscription type where you pay like $15 a month, but they have four that are the other kind, the dual currency.
The free?
Yes. They're getting far more people to try it and stick with it and keep going than they are with trying to get people to pay $14 a month, even though some of these people are probably paying more than $14 a month buying the other currency.
The two-track model actually may end up paying off for companies like that, too, because people will buy this little currency stuff piecemeal by piecemeal, not realizing that they're spending actually $20 a month.
Exactly.
This whole thing, it's a slippery slope, actually, because I was involved on certain online games where you pay for the extra. And at first, you pay a little money here, a little money there, but then you realize you've ran out of gold, if you will, or gold doubloons or whatever the game uses, that you end up going to pay even more. And you start adding up how much it's costing you after you've been playing it for 6 to 8 months. You're like talking $200 or $300. Nickel and dimes you to death.
Remember on that article reading a post from a particular person who replied called Louis B and saying he spends $200 a month for something called...
Oof.
Hang on a second, I'm trying to remember the name. It was... No, I've lost the name now. I didn't write it down. But there was something he was using, a similar version for Civ 4, he'd be willing to pay $60 to $100 a month, and I thought, that's ridiculous.
I saw that, it's like, come on. Doesn't matter how much money you spend on these games, there's always some yahoo in there that'll be spending more than you.
Yes.
So any bonuses you actually get is going to be counterbalanced by someone else breaking the bank.
Then there's a potential there to introduce other tools which make you relatively unstoppable for even more money. As you say, slippery slope. It can go out of control.
Well, I like the idea, though, that having a two-track type of thing where you can play for free but buy nickel and dime stuff, or you could pay maybe $15 a month and get everything. So if you find your calculator thing and you're like, wait a second, I just spent $25 a month on this nickel stuff, you can convert your character or game, whatever, avatar, into the per-month $15, the traditional World of Warcraft pricing or something like that. That might be not a bad thing. At one level, it allows people to try out the game for free, or if you only want to play an hour or two a week or something, and you pay $5 a month, maybe it'd be worth it. But there's also another track where if you find yourself going to be paying a ton of money, but you can pay $15 a month and just do it that way.
The game Lewis B. was referring to is Entropa Universe, which is...
I was about to ask if that was it.
Ah, yes.
There's people that have stuff that's worth literally hundreds of thousands of dollars in that game, and they have actually sold it for that, for real-life money.
On eBay or whatever?
Yeah, something. It's just, it's insane.
I find it very worrying that people can spend such insane amounts of money on a game. Surely half the joy is to start from the beginning and build up. I mean, that's exactly one of the reasons why we play Civ in the first place. It's not as much fun to say, oh, I'm going to buy the Roman Empire dominating half the planet in 1800 AD. Well, thanks, but I've not really had the enjoyment of doing that.
I'm sure we've all heard of the stories of people selling World of Warcraft characters for thousands of dollars to people. If you have that much money, why are you wasting it on that?
Exactly.
Yeah. Years ago, I sold a spare Ultima Online account because it had a house that was in some area and housing was really short at the time. I got $700 for it.
Whoa! Wow.
Nice.
Did you claim
yeah.
that? Did you claim that?
What? Yes. Yes. Good grief, people.
I remember one story very recently, or maybe not that recently, where there was some transaction over some kind of sword in some game like this, and one ended up killing the other person in real life because of it.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that just happened.
Yeah.
Well, that's just not playing with a full deck.
More ways than one.
Well, that's the thing with people killing each other over Dungeons & Dragons when it was first out. Someone jumping off a roof thinking they can fly.
Yeah, or people going out and killing other people because they killed people in the game and they want to know whether that would actually kill somebody in real life.
Right.
It's like, okay. Yeah, that's obviously the game's fault.
Yeah, some people just get a little too invested in these things, and which is why, I mean, I think a lot of the pay for stuff might get a little out of hand. Someone gets too addicted and they start spending, like, said, $200 a month and think, well, then, you know, no big deal.
It's like a gambling addiction, if you will.
Mm.
Yeah.
You get hooked into it and, yeah.
Yeah, made even more slippery slope.
And we spend a lot of money on all types of entertainment. It's just bizarre for us to understand.
Yeah.
With those kind of addiction things, even that dural currency system in Puzzle Pirates, if someone has the money or at least is able to get access to the money, say, through credit and then is spending all of this time playing the game, that's true, that's not going to be able to address that. But on the microtransactions to begin with, as Troy mentioned at the beginning, in the ZT Online, they've got 10 million users, ARPU, average revenue per user of $40 a month.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
So it's not that every user is spending $40 a month, and then you start doing the math, and it's kind of like,
You get half the users spending nothing if the other guys are spending $120 or something dollars a month.
Exactly. The thing about ZT Online, selling items, the items are attached to the owner. You can't, once you have them, you cannot separate them, so you don't have that. But the way in ZT Online, the way to gain equipment, is where you pay real money to open treasure chests. But they are in-game slot machines, as Soren says, because these chests only have a small chance of producing something useful. And finding the best equipment often requires opening thousands of chests. And then as a further incentive, every day the company awards some other kind of award on the person who purchases the most chests.
Oh.
So I'm like, okay.
That is quite a clear definition of gambling.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
There's no interpretation there.
I agree with Soren. He said, quote, it's like a con job designed to suck away all of the player's money, unquote, as with ZT Online. Now, that's not to say that it's entirely the game's fault and the player holds no responsibility whatsoever. It's kind of like getting what we were saying about people killing somebody in real life over something in a game. Whenever people have said that to me, like, video games cause people to kill people, and I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, someone robs somebody, uses gloves to break in and not leave fingerprints, so obviously the people who manufactured the glove are guilty of that crime as well, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question about whether or not you like this approach and the question about the culture difference between the East and West, I think with massively multiplayer online play games as an example, role-playing games, that has a basis for this pay-for model. But if we're going to do that pay-for model, I think the dual currency system in Puzzle Pirates is the way to go, because you avoid it from being, well, yeah, you can pay for stuff, but it's only aesthetics, cosmetics, big deal. Or it's something more significant where the richest players are going to be the dominant players because they get access to certain things that other players don't. Or like with Travian, part of it is you get access to something better with the interface.
Right.
There are a number of angles you can take that. If we were looking at it in terms of a strategy game, like doing it for a Civ 5, no. Sid has talked about doing a massively multiplayer online Civ game. He's talked about how would that be implemented.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that if you were going to do that, a massively multiplayer online game has different design decisions required along with different business decisions. If you were going to design a massively multiplayer online game and you want to do that fee-based system, that makes sense. I think that's fair to look at that. But don't try to bring that into the strategy system. Have a massive multiplayer online game, but then also have your Civ 5. It's kind of like with the argument when Civilization Revolution came out. Oh, no, that's Civ 5 now. That's Civ 5 now. They're abandoning the PC. No. It was just, this is something separate that we're trying. And if Firaxis approaches the massive multiplayer online game the same, no, we're not abandoning strategy gaming. We're trying something else. And then if they do that, the Puzzle Pirates model is the way to go. As far as the concern about, you know, the people wanting to be able to buy a boxed game and it's got everything in it, yes, we're doing that, but it just seems to be a natural evolution of, okay, you've got the game, now there is expansion packs. Okay. There have been some cases, say with Civilization Revolution, where some of the downloadable content or DLC has been paid for. Some of it's been free, right? You're tempting people with the free stuff, and then it's like, oh, if you like this free stuff, then you might like this pay-for downloadable content.
A lot of games now are going to downloadable content. A lot of games are testing that out, especially like some role-playing games where they'll add different areas that you can download. It seems to be something that is continuing onward, and you might see in games in the future a little bit taking a page from this type of free-to-play, pay-for-other-stuff is maybe the original game will be $40, but then, oh, well, we have this other area where you can buy for another $10 or something like that.
Yeah, you know, there are people who are interested in that. They're going to pursue that.
The other thing about downloadable content is what makes it, I think, a little bit more interesting to developers is, well, you know, you do a downloadable content, you go online to get it. And guess what? They can verify if your game is actually legit as well at the same time. So I think that's why they really like it, because they're like, oh, look, this can cut down on piracy.
And you could also do that with, oh, here's the latest patch to the game. Oh, you pirated the game? You shouldn't have done that. And what's one of the reasons why you shouldn't have done that? Here's a practical consideration for you. You're not going to be able to play with who knows how many people. It's not because they know you pirated the game directly. It's because you don't have the latest patch. And then if someone says, well, go get the latest patch, you're going to be like,
So that's what his problem was last week.
I can't play tonight, guys.
But the objections that people have to it, and not everybody does this, but I have antivirus software. I pay for the software, but I also pay every year. It's not a monthly fee, but I pay every year to continue to have that software be updated with the latest definition files. And it's also true that if you don't pay the subscription, it's not just that you can't get access to the updated definition files anymore. The software itself stops working. I don't think the software should stop working. I think it should be you don't have access to the latest stuff. There is room for this system, even in a Civ, and that's part of the reason why I raised this issue, was because Sid had talked about a massively multiplayer online game. There's another issue for me to be able to continue to pay a subscription model every year. The issue of how much it is, and that's a totally separate issue, but the premise that I have to pay a renewal every year to continue to get access to the latest things, it's kind of like if we were to deploy this game and you're going to connect to the server to be able to play it. The developer is still working on it. The developer could still be working on it years from now. And so just like with the antivirus companies, they're still out there. They're finding the latest threats. They're neutralizing the threats. They're communicating and they're distributing that. By all means, fair to say, you need to continue to pay a subscription fee in order to get this, because sure, we've got all this money from people buying this software at the outset, but maybe there's saturation now, other people have other choices. How are we going to be able to continue to support the users? And really, you're paying that subscription model is helping you in the end, because if so many people didn't do that, right, then there wouldn't be a sustainable model, and then they wouldn't continue to support the software, it wouldn't be updated as well.
I think the problem I have, maybe being a bit old-fashioned in terms of how I like to play my games, but I wouldn't be very keen on the idea of having to pay once and then pay again every year. One, I think it's pushing people towards piracy, because people are going to go, well, if you're going to be that cheeky with me, I've got to have less respect with you. I think there's a difference we need to distinguish between, for example, an antivirus package. There are new viruses coming into being all the time, so there needs to be a certain cat and mouse, one keeping up with the other, which does need some financing. Which I don't quite see as being quite the same with games, or certainly not to the same extent. This is the whole principle behind expansion packs, for example, why if they want to move the game onto the next part, they sell an expansion pack. And I'm quite happy with that, but have to have a subscription every year to actually be able to play the game at all, I'm not happy with the idea myself.
If they were going to do something like that with a Civilization V, I would agree.
Yeah.
If it's going to be, say it's a Civ, it's a massively multiplayer online game, it's based online, and this is the way it's going to be from the outset. It's not something that I'm interested in either.
Yes.
I don't object to it.
Well, it's a very different model of game altogether, isn't it, if they're making a game of that route?
Exactly. Some of the games that Soren talks about, part of it's implied that there is some software that you do install as a base. Some others, I think, are just right through your web browser. The only thing that kind of makes me cringe a little bit is, what if for whatever reason, the company shutting down would be the ultimate thing, but what if they decided, we're not going to support this game anymore? You've been paying for this software all of this time. Everything is residing on the server, or at least some of it.
Yep.
And if something were to happen, whether that's temporarily or permanently, recognize that fact. That's another reason why these kind of games, I'm kind of like, ooh, no way for me to really save what I'm doing.
Well, you could apply that to every MMO ever, because eventually they're all going to shut down at some point. And then what happens to all those hours you spent getting your elite purples? They're gone.
Is that a rock band? Deep Purple.
No, elite.
Elite.
In conclusion here, perhaps...
Fire beware.
Yeah.
Number 10, from episode 65.
Wait, did you just say that Turbine won it all last year?
Yes.
Yes.
Like the entire thing?
Yes, I did.
Oh, fuck this thing then.
Behold, the power of fanboys.
I have no respect for it anymore.
Number 9, from episode 67.
One big stack of Doom versus several smaller stack of Dooms.
There's no such thing as too much stack of Doom.
Practically speaking, you don't want so many units on a particular tile that they go and strike. Not that that's ever happened before. Once.
One big stack of Doom versus several smaller stack of Dooms? How about several big stacks of Doom?
There you go.
Number 8, from episode 79.
Wait, she's already 3 and she's not playing Civ yet? Come on, Dad, really?
Yeah, I usually start about the time they're able to read.
Are you reading that book again? Are you kidding me? There's a computer over there. You go play Civ.
Right.
Keep your priorities straight.
Number 7, from episode 75.
Or it becomes the neutral civilization, you know?
So it would become Switzerland?
If Switzerland had privateers and ninjas.
What are you saying, they don't?
Clearly they do.
Well, they're landlocked, so...
Clearly they do. The lack of proof is proof enough.
Number 6, from episode 60.
I do like Emancipation, just because of all the fun cottage hamlet, village stuff. And also because, you know, people get mad if other people have it and you don't.
Oh, yes, the penalty.
Yeah.
That's actually most of my reason for switching it. The growth is nice, yes. But also the to the other civs is great.
And of course, yeah, one of the things I do like is if I'm the first one to switch over to make all the other civs get people pissed. Exactly. I'm like, yeah.
Yes, I've researched emancipation. Time to screw the AI over.
Number 5, from episode 72. Though in the context of Civilization 4, titles before and since in the series 2 have and continue to elicit roleplay approaches.
Roleplay. Yes, I do. I play quite a few multiplayer games in the diplomacy games. You have to roleplay there. You write stories, and a lot of the business is based on that.
Yeah, Stony the First had said that when I play Civ on my comfort difficulty level, which I don't think he actually defined, but that's right, I always intend to roleplay a bit, such as setting my own goals besides winning the game, going for some historical accuracy, before starting the game, setting a goal with the leader you pick. I do this occasionally to increase the fun factor in Civ to make it feel more epic in a way. Also, it adds a personal touch, quote-unquote. And I would say, with the poll entries there, I think I'm under, not the first one where I completely roleplay all of my games, I think I'm under the majority category where I sometimes make decisions based on role-playing a bit, but not when it can be game-breaking. Always trying to keep the end goal in mind.
Well, I think everybody has their own style of play, which, you know, depends on single-player, multiplayer, and your various purposes of play. There are League folks, and they don't role-play other than in killer mode. I like to go for a religion that's historically connected with the history of the civ I choose, if I get a choice. And I also have done the diplomacy games. And then, you know, some folks play the scenarios, which involves an outlook of a particular historical era.
You mentioned if some people are just in killer mode. Well, you can roleplay a bit there. But kill fast or slow today? Heeny, meeny, miny, mo.
It's all in quick. 3 hours and I... And we'll all get you.
I don't know if you guys are aware, but the Diplo games that they play on Apolliton, I play in them quite often, actually focuses on role play, and it kind of tries to downplay the winning aspect. Personally, though, I usually play to win.
Yeah, I find it to be more fun that way. Now, if it looks like I'm going to lose, or I'm pretty sure I'm going to lose, I think we've discussed before on the show, like, if it looks like you're going to die, do you keep on playing until you die? And the answer is, no, I don't, but... If I'm getting behind the eight ball, I will try to get back into it, but yeah, generally I prefer to play to win. It's more fun that way for some reason.
I probably role play a little bit more if it's single player, because if I lose, who cares? No one saw it.
Number 4, from episode 83. Inherent, as compared to specific, siege capabilities for units is an argument that precedes and succeeds this discussion.
Siege as attachments. In atypical fashion on Polycast, rather than saying this thread was started by so-and-so and he or she said this, we can actually have the person who started this thread say what it is they said.
Sorry, you have to introduce this. You don't get a choice. Just FYI.
If I can remember it by now. This thread is by the illustrious poster Kamikaze, and it's entitled Siege as Attachments.
Is that why you named yourself Kamikaze, because it was in praise of this poster?
Oh, absolutely. He's been my hero for a while now. This thread is about using siege as attachments as opposed to individual units as they currently are in the game. So as the opening poster, Kamikaze, i.e. me, says, siege are built as per in Civ 4, but do not represent the same type of unit as in Civ 4. They're meant to be attachments, they're meant to be attached to a standard unit, and then they can be used as a move for that unit. This should reduce their power. We all know they're overpowered as they are in the game. They can be thrown away. They're expendable. Make them more useful in bombarding other units instead of simply reducing them through collateral damage. And overall, it should really reduce their effectiveness, which probably should be a good thing, reducing stacks as well, reduces the power of stacks, and it also should allow for the greater cost of siege to be taken into account by the player.
So basically you're saying treat them like a bit like great generals in the fact that they can be attached to units.
Yeah, precisely.
Not a bad idea.
It's not bad.
Interesting. Kamikaze, can I just ask you in one sentence, what do you think is the primary advantage of this system? Really, is it worth the extra complexity?
Reducing the power of siege.
Well, there are several other ways you could go about doing that.
Yes, this one it seems to me to be more realistic.
I don't really like this idea where you write, when an infantry with an artillery attachment is adjacent to an enemy city, the infantry can use it to bombard the city. Did you actually meant to cause damage to units?
I'm of the preference that we bring back bombarding of units as well, instead of having artillery specifically attack, which isn't really a realistic representation of what they can do.
That's true.
I wouldn't so much say bombard a specific unit, more you bombard a tile and any
the
units
stack.
Get splatted. Yeah.
Yeah, bombard the stack.
You bombard a tile and it doesn't matter whether there's a city in it, a unit in it.
Or a bunch of units.
Improvements, they all just get flattened.
You could just bombard them and everything would happen at once, you're saying. So you get like a certain percentage of city defense lowered.
Well, the thing is, when you're attacking, it's always bombard, but you're bombarding the tile. It doesn't matter what's in it. The damage is then calculated based on units might be defended by the city until it's down to a certain percentage of strength. Then they start taking damage. But you can bombard outside the city and the units will take damage and tile improvements will take damage and things like that.
So let's say bombarding a single unit infantry wouldn't really do much for you, but bombarding 10 units of infantry would be really hurtful. Basically, that's even realistic.
I don't think that this would necessarily nerf siege at all.
No, you could nerf it by...
And you would still have the problem with the defender having initiative with the bombardment and just railing the offensive stacks for a collateral before the offensive stacks could respond to it.
There's one big conceptual difference. If you can bombard units, let's say if you could bombard units without attacking them, the cap on damage that you can cause with siege becomes, well, less annoying.
This all presupposes that siege units are currently overpowered. I think definitely in the case of multiplayer, they can be, but it's not really that much of a problem with the AI, or at least in my experience, it hasn't.
Partly because the AI is not that smart, and that's the primary thing, isn't it?
Yeah, that is the primary thing. It's really not necessary against the AI on low levels where it can't match your production by getting 50% off of all its units. Whereas on high level, siege becomes mandatory to have any chance or a tech lead or some other advantage, like getting to them before they can actually take advantage of their production boosts. But generally, late game stack warfare against AI, just to overcome its hammer bonuses, you need to inflict a lot of collateral on it. And that makes siege mandatory.
Kamikaze, do you currently feel that they're overpowered? I mean, that's why you made the post, right?
Well, they're mainly overpowered in attack, I reckon. You have stacks, you have a lot of siege in stacks, and you can go to any city and basically wear the defenses right down. Longbowmen, city garrison 2, that's no problem if you have a couple of catapults with you.
Instead of actually having it as you bombard a unit, cause damage, I was just thinking like a couple of other games treat siege, Total War. Siege, what it means is, actually, you don't use it to attack the city. What it does, it allows you to effectively surround the city and slowly just wear it down. You don't bombard it, you just sit there and just go, the units just sort of lose health as they run out of food and...
That's actually something that's bothered me in Civ for quite some time, that they don't have it. But maybe we could do it in a similar manner, like naval units have the ability to blockade, land blockade.
You're blockading around a city.
Yeah.
And you basically say, look, you can't get out, you can't get in, your trade is cut off, your food starts running out.
You can't wear blockaded titles.
The game mechanics would have to change, because if you're blockading on land, or even if you're going for pillaging, you're not capturing cities and you're not expediting the war. And the penalty for staying at war with somebody is very severe in this game, as is. I mean, people tech away from you. Now, a lot of the AIs are much more likely to declare on you. Well, pretty much every AI is more likely to declare on you if you're at war with somebody already, and gives the target a chance to build more units in all the other cities. So there's really not much benefit to going on blockading or pillage sprees in this game, other than the fact that if you blockade with, like, privateers, it causes the AI to spam units it normally wouldn't that hurt it.
But we were talking about land blockades here.
Well, I know, but...
You could literally starve the city out.
if you're land blockading, that means you are at war, and sure, you're starving one city, but unless the game mechanics are changed, the penalty for doing that is so severe it isn't worth it. Well, almost without exception.
Stuart also assumed that the city defense would go down the more turns the city was blockaded.
Because the defenders would be running out of food, getting ill, and...
Well, it's also realistic as is. I mean, soldiers don't live 6,000 years. I think that's a basic aspect of a lot of gameplay, that it's irrelevant that people eat and people sleep.
I actually think it would be very fun, Stuart's idea. Think about it. How interesting is that? You blockade a city, taking away basically all its cultural defense bonuses, but keeping the physical defenses intact. That would add a bit of strategy. It would boost the non-cultural defenses you can build, because sieges can't take those away.
What about laying siege to a city that happens to be building a wonder that you're trying to build? You want to build the wonder, so you lay siege to them. They can't build that wonder whilst it's under siege.
I would not mind siege having an impact on what the city adjacent to, or even units having an impact on the city they're adjacent to, and cutting into their production. That makes sense, and it does give some incentive for the defenders to attack, although there's plenty with siege already. But it would take away some of the unbelievable circumstances of just magically generating a ton of units in the defending city while the siege is on the outside of it.
Exactly.
I really hate when that happens. Really, the AI just moves a couple of units in from nowhere, whips out like 2 longbows or 4 longbows, and the time it takes for you to just bombard the city down, and then you're attacking 15 units in the city instead of like 4.
Unattached siege units. They'd be just non-functional because otherwise be inclined to just not attach them at all.
I thought they'd basically be like pieces of machinery. They have no one to operate them. That's what the standard unit that they're attached to does. They fulfill the role of the operator of the machinery.
So they have no defensive power?
No, they're basically like workers.
Oh, I see, I see.
So 50% chance that it's captured, 50% chance that it's destroyed?
Yeah.
Once the parent unit has died.
Maybe even have a promotion where if a unit has this promotion, the artillery is always destroyed and never captured by foreign forces.
What, like a scuttle promotion?
Yeah, exactly. It was used pretty much in World War II. I mean, you had Leningrad, Stalingrad... even Moscow for a while.
Sieges have been prominent in warfare since cannons.
I think it might be interesting if the power of the siege weapon were corresponded to the power of the person operating it. You could have like siege scale, like specific promotions for team together units.
Well, you could have a bit of combination, really. You have a warrior with a cannon. Well, do a hell of a lot better than a warrior with a catapult. But if you upgraded that to an infantryman, then he'd be better trained, and he could use the catapult just as well.
Maybe a better way to do this would be, let's say, simple units, like a warrior with a cannon, is just as good as an infantry with a cannon. But when you attack that warrior, well, the warrior has practically nil chances of scuttling the cannon, so your enemy takes it.
Is wearing a loincloth and fire cannon.
Rambo.
I was thinking more, a warrior with a cannon... he's going to be better than a warrior with a catapult, but an infantryman with a catapult will easily be better, just because he's better trained, than a warrior with a cannon. So a better unit with a lesser equipment will still do better than a crap unit with brilliant equipment.
I don't know about that. I would much rather see some advanced trained like troop from nowadays using a catapult aimed in my general direction than anybody pointing a cannon at me.
Why don't we just limit units to which cannons and catapults can be drafted on? I mean, you can use a catapult with ancient and medieval and Renaissance units, but you can't use it with modern and industrial units.
Well, you could make that limit by just simply obsoleting the different types of siege unit.
Exactly.
Just to bring this conversation back full, siege being the separate and independent units, having read your suggestion, Kamikaze, and also hearing the subsequent discussion, my opinion hasn't changed. There are certain things from what you have said that I would like to extract and take into the game, but going back to the original question about whether they should be attachments or separate and independent units, I still think siege units should be separate units. Towards a diversification of your army, the need for offense, or perhaps if you just want it for offense, and also can be wanted for defense if not even needed. I think a lot of the time when we get into a siege discussion, we're talking about the offensive part, but it also has defensive benefit as well if you so choose to use it that way. But I do like the discussion with regards to siege units being used as a land blockade, given the strength of this, the need to have it surrounded by a city, just giving another reason for the city that's surrounded by siege units to get rid of them, because there still is enough reason now to be able to get rid of siege units. Whether that affects your production or not, well, it would. If that city was no longer had access to iron, for instance, and you're in the ancient era, then no more swordsmen for you in that particular city. The part where you have about the unscorted siege units having a chance to be captured, I like that idea. It's been compared to the ability of capturing unescorted workers. The difference I see between siege units and workers is, of course, that workers are non-combat units and siege units are. So it wouldn't be, yes, you automatically capture that siege unit if it was unescorted. Either a 50-50 chance, perhaps as also been suggested, improve the odds of either it being captured or it being destroyed even through promotions, whether it be scuttle, like, oh, if my siege unit gets by itself, then I want to lessen the chance that my enemy is going to be able to capture that scuttle, or you could improve a particular offensive unit you have to be able to capture unescorted units.
I'd add one thing about if they're not attached to anything or they're unescorted, they can't move because there's no one there to move them.
That's a good idea.
Well, typically an artillery crew would be trained with people who would be trained to fire the weapon.
That's true.
Yeah, so I always considered them a part of the unit, even though you didn't visually see them necessarily. That was implied that the unit was people specifically trained for the use of the siege unit. They couldn't do any other combat, right? They couldn't do anything else except control that particular unit.
Typically, if cavalry got up close to catapults, it was a disaster, because the sidearms that the catapult or cannon men had were of no match against men on horses with sabers. It'd just be, oh, let's make a mess.
Number 3. From episode 73, considering an ability to export animals from one part of the world to another is one that is not going to go away anytime soon.
Let's talk about introducing animals.
Introducing animals. Hi, lion. This is dog. Dog, this is lion.
Somehow a segue.
Hello, tiger. This is bear.
Mago Barca said, wouldn't it be great if you could send animals to another continent or breed them in your own continent for a cost of 100 gold or even you that as a slider? That's a direct quote. We're getting kind of the general idea here.
Breed them. Nice. Can we get an animation for that too?
No.
This sounds like a Sims expansion pack.
I suppose you could argue that this would introduce an element of realism.
Oh yeah, we don't like realism.
I really don't see how that would be fun.
Well, it's too much realism, again. It's too much micromanagement, I think. Because it'll become Civilization 4 Animal Crossing or something.
Animal Crossing.
Civilization 4 Animal Kingdom.
Yeah, Animal Kingdom.
Let's see. Civ My Way said that he's working on a Civ variant where animals which can move around and have to be captured. He said that in addition to this, there will be a number of exotic animals. Capturing these will be harder, and they will allow for the creation of circus in Renaissance times and further a zoo in modern If you're going to add something like that, maybe that had like a circus and a zoo as a building, although I don't really think we need any more buildings.
Lame.
You don't have to hold back, Imran. You can say what you really mean.
Well, he's saying that he's working on it so the animals will move around and you have to catch them. I just have this awful visual of like these stupid little workers chasing the sheep around in circles and never being able to catch them. That is a great way to waste time.
Isn't that already represented in the game by, say, pastures? I mean, you have captured them to the point that you're able to actually make use of them now on that particular tile that they happen to be on.
But Dan, we have to introduce, like, ridiculous micromanagement. Because apparently that's in now.
Because otherwise the fun's not in it.
Because everybody knows micromanagement is the most fun part of the game.
And it's more realistic.
Oh, yes.
Number 2. From episode 82, the is it in, is it out, back in, and back out again. Zone of control mechanic for Civ.
The topic is a little bit old. It started in July 16 of 2007. That is pretty much necromancy. Ward Rouse started saying that more self-respecting turn-based games have zone of control implemented in one form or another. Do you think it should be brought back to Civ? I'm pretty sure both Civ 1 and 2 had it, and I think there was some form of it in Civ 3. That is pretty much true. I don't quite understand why that particular feature was removed from Civ 4. I can only assume it was to dumb down the movement, make it more intuitive. Well, that is pretty much discussable. I personally would like to see it back. It would add another way of strategy, making wars more interesting. You would no longer be able to simply bypass a simple defender on a hill, for example. It would make forts more relevant as well. I should remind that this post is from 2007. There is even a co-host here that simply didn't play Civ 4 in that time.
That's correct. I joined January 08. I did not realize this was a necromancy because somebody responded to it pretty late. And sometimes these topics go crazy. And once you mention the necromancy and I check the date, I'm like, oh, wow.
I would just like to remind that this thread is because it is from 2007. When it refers to forts, it is not referring to Beyond the Sword forts, but to Vanilla and Warlords forts that were a little bit less useful than Beyond the Sword forts are. But I agree with what Phil says in the last page or something like that, that if we had Zone of Control in Civ 4, it would give a tremendous advantage to the defender. To say the truth, I don't know any game that has retarded movement for the attacker and Zone of Control. Even, I'm going to advertise a little, even Empire Total War that came out recently has Zone of Control, but when in war, you don't have any penalty of movement in foreign lands. Bringing that to C4, in my opinion, is pretty much forcing the attacker to go or against bad terrain or against strong unit fortified somewhere.
Listeners, just to clarify, Phil and the main team are synonymous here. To add to my point, the main thing with the limited movement in enemy territory in Civ 4 is that it opens up the attacker to collateral, basically whenever the defender feels like hitting them with collateral, as long as they have roads. Zone of control, one of the best strategies the attacker can follow if he's not using two move units is to stick to defensive terrain, which now the defender could sit on. And you couldn't even bypass it. You'd have to attack it there. Or the defender could just opt to attack you directly with collateral, which it already does. It just adds another layer of defense to the side of the war that's already very strongly favored in Civ 4. I believe that that's the actual reason it was removed, not to dumb down the movement, because actually the movement can be pretty difficult now when you leave yourself vulnerable.
Well, I'm not quite so refined in strategy games, so I'm just happy the Zone of Control is gone because it was infuriating in the old games.
No. Oh, really?
Trying to figure out where you could not move the units.
You could not move the units. Like William says about C4, one of his strategy ideas was pretty much one unit after the other and his attacker could simply not find a way to attack.
Oh, would the AI try to, like, go around zones of control? Like, could you make a maze or something? That'd be hilarious. It'd be like playing tower defense in Civ or something. Not exactly the intention of the game, but it'd be pretty funny. Especially with Civ 3 Siege, just bombard them while they're running through your maze, and they all at the end, they're all redlined.
We already have a maze script. We don't need to make more mazes.
I think a lot of the complaints about Zone of Control in earlier Civs was the fact that it did not just apply to enemy units.
I'd forgotten about that too. That could be really annoying, you're right.
So Lord Rawl, who just started this thread more than 2 years ago, made it clear that he was saying that this would only apply to enemy units. And I was going through the arguments either in favor of Zone of Control returning. Some people were fine with the way it was before. Some people wanted it tweaked as a feature. Some people did not want it in there as a feature. And one of the things Lord Rawl said is, in conclusion to his opening post, there could also be promotions or inherent abilities that would allow them to ignore zones of control. I was thinking, rather than it being a feature in the game, make it a promotion ability. So rather than an inherent unit ability that would allow them to ignore zones of control, that would allow them to actually exercise a zone of control. With the commando promotion, you can use enemy roads and railroads. There is only one commando promotion right now. Why not have zone of control a commando 2 promotion ability, where commando itself requires combat 4 and the military science technology, and does not apply to archery units, only recon, artillery, mounted, melee, gunpowder, and armored. The only thing that I think would need to be tweaked if we did that is I'm not so certain about a recon unit being able to exercise a zone of control.
But this way, I think it would allow us to get around the fact that it would be either in or not in. And then that way, if someone really wanted to be able to exercise that, then they would have to go down the combat promotion path quite considerably to make a direct effort for that. And in that respect, it would have limited applications in the game because of how long it would take you. And it would take you to, if not the mid, maybe even the later point in the game when it wouldn't be quite so, how shall we say, devastating to combat.
Well, if you wanted the Commando 2 promotion, that would be something like 30-something experience points, right?
Yes. The reason you don't see a lot of Commando currently is for just that reason. It costs so much experience to get it that you can't really make it practical by getting enough units.
I see a lot of Commando promotions. I use a lot of spies.
Yes.
But maybe that is true. A Commando 2 promotion would need, even with charismatic wizards, it would be a bucketload of experience points needed to get there. It would be probably interesting for Always War games, because in that game, units get completely stupid amounts of experience points. But in a normal game, yes, it would be quite complicated to get that promotion in a usable time, at least maybe until the time of tanks. And when tanks come by, probably Zone of Control would be pretty much useless. Not sure if I would like that much of an idea, but it would be interesting to see if we could pull that out in a sensible way.
I suppose you could make it even an ability with the first Commando, but I know, as you're saying, it would take a while to get there. When we're thinking about Zones of Control and how it's been implemented before, just how much terrain a Zone of Control could apply for, the fact that it would come later in the game would, as I said, wouldn't be quite so devastating, because you would have, or at least hopefully would have, a more diversified army with different types and a larger army. And so if you really want to go down that path, then it's kind of a reward, because a Zone of Control can be quite powerful. So if you are able to get to the point where you can get to the Commando promotion, then that's another ability. And perhaps for those people who say, well, I don't see a lot, and I haven't either, and perhaps there's another reason to try to get to Commando if that's something that you really want to exercise.
It would be another tool in the box, but it would probably need a lot of tweaking to be a competitive approach to the game. Like I said one time, every time that someone says that thinking is impossible, it's C4, 1 year after someone proves that otherwise.
Even if it was decided that Commando was too late, you could even have it a little farther down the combat line. Obviously not Combat 1 or something, maybe Combat 3 or 4.
Yeah, Combat 4 would be a good idea. Remember that Commando comes with Combat 5, isn't it?
Yeah, it's after your fourth combat promotion is when Commando becomes available.
And having the military science tech.
Yes. Pretty much the only way you'd get it before that anyway is a great general, though.
Well, I was about to say. I was just trying to find a way to have it in the game. I was seeing both sides of the argument in terms of being a feature and the argument about how cultural borders right now really impact that in part, and comments that some other people are saying, I think you, Phil, about that. You just simply couldn't add Zone of Control in how Civ 4 is now, because it would just unnecessarily complicate things and make it even more of a defender advantage. I figured that this might be a way, again, to have it as an ability rather than a feature, so it's still in the game, but it has limited usefulness in terms of get there, but once you get there, it could be considerably powerful.
Yes, but like I said, it would be hard to pull out, not be either overpowering or underpowered. Having a feature just because you have a feature is a little bit fluff.
And this way it becomes more ability than a feature. Playtesting still required, but not quite as extensively as if you say it's in the game from the outset, and then here are the rules, which can get quite complicated. Because it seemed like to me, in order to try to make it balance, not being too overpowered or underpowered, it was going to become too complicated. And then, as we've said before, we're going to need a spreadsheet in order to keep track of whether or not that this is balanced or not.
Yeah, right. You have a point in there.
There was a link to an article on Gamma Sutra, an interview with Sid Meier, and he was asked, if one thing you could change about the original civilization, what would it be? And he said, Zones of Control. Quote, looking at it today, I might try to streamline the game a little bit more and make the rules not quite as detailed or obscure than some of them were in the original game, unquote.
Well, C4, it still has a lot of obscure rules.
Oh, don't get me started on some of those.
Rather than adding one back in, there were some interesting ideas in here, such as that they should apply to forts, and, oh, you should be able to build forts outside your cultural borders, giving promotions, as I said, to units to be able to negate that possibility. Oh, that's a good idea, but then kind of the one step forward was two steps back, either because of a complication factor or the fact that the foundation it was built upon was already in and of itself complicated, so we really were treating a symptom of the problem rather than the problem itself. So this way I just avoid the problem of having, you're not asking the question, should zone of control be a feature? Or rather, how do we make zone of control a feature? No, it's not a feature, it's simply an ability.
It could pull out in that way, but I still have some bittersweet feelings about having zone of control in the game. It's just a thing of mine.
It certainly is a tactical monster.
Well, I still remember the times that I played Alpha Centauri, and that has a pretty strong zone of control that you can only bypass with a promotion. Well, what would be in C4 promotion? Alpha Centauri has a completely different way of dealing with things. It had an ability that you can add to the units that was a cloaking device that allowed to bypass the zone of control, but it was pretty much like C2 was. Zone of control was rain and absolute, and the only way you can pass that was the cloaking device that would be pretty much similar to what you are proposing. Kill the unit or orbital insertion, that was pretty much like the paratroopers in Beyond the Sword. I am afraid that it can be either too strong or either too weak, or too strong and too weak at the same time. It can happen.
Yeah, that actually happens more than people would think. It happens any time something is almost impossible to get, but when you get it, it just breaks the game. Those are examples of things that are too strong and too weak at the same time.
I didn't actually play that much of Alpha Centauri. How accessible was that to the player? Was that a technology or ability? Like, would it be as much effort?
It was an ability that came with a tech somewhere in the middle of the game.
Whoa, and that applied to any unit?
You could apply to any unit. It had an extra cost to build the unit. It was like an extra. Alpha Centauri has a system of can add or remove things of a unit. You can customize the units, pay more or less for the unit you build. The cloaking device was an ability. That's why I'm comparing what Dan was proposing in here. It was something that you can add to any unit as long as you had the tech and you were in the mood to pay the extra price for it. It was not very expensive, if I recall correctly. In certain aspects, it was at the same time weaker and stronger than what Dan is proposing, because you could add to any unit, but it was not exactly as expensive as getting a 30 experience point promotion like you could have in C4.
I played it, but I was young when I played it, and I don't remember a whole lot. It's been over 10 years.
I still play it from time to time. That is why it came to my mind.
Takes us to the end of the control of zones of this conversation.
Yeah, pretty much.
Ba-dum-tsh.
Whoa, that was a joke?
Yeah, but it was pretty bad, so that's why the ba-dum-tsh was kind
of... Yeah, that's what triggered me to realize that it was a joke, though. Before that, I didn't know.
You see, Phil, I took that joke and I applied the cloaking device to it.
Oh, I see. It blew right by me. I couldn't control it. Couldn't prevent it.
Number 5 from episode 74.
With us, we have Grandpa Troll, Dan Q, Makalua, Beta, and Emron.
You know, you did forget to introduce somebody, Scott.
Is that Dan?
No, you know them very well, actually, better than anybody else here.
I said your name, so I know that,
Yourself.
Oh, me, yeah, and me, of course, Alpha Shard, yeah.
Number 4 from episode 63.
You go ahead, you conquer an AI, it's great, you're driving up the coast, and you just get everything set like 1-2 tiles away, and you're running a trade route economy. But it's a drag.
He did that purposely to hurt your trade economy.
That's why I purposely hit the raise city button. It fixes all those problems.
But what if it has all these wonders, you don't want to raise it.
Well, yes.
Sometimes yes.
Mackie likes raising the cities, especially when they're holy.
Once. I did it once.
Number 3 from episode 68.
It's even more fun when you are sitting there and you start playing, say, at 9 or 10 o'clock at night. Now I'm just going to play a couple hours and go to bed. Why is it getting lighter in here? Oh, crap!
Number 2 from episode 80.
Daniel Quick.
Am I really here?
Makalua.
Unlike Dan, I don't have an existence to a Christmas. I also can't say existence. Oh, forget it.
Honorable mention the second from episode 61.
I can paraphrase, though. It depends.
It's a summary of every polycast ever.
Brilliant!
Honorable mention the first from episode 73.
Tip number 2, make sure your game is installed correctly. That's a good way to play Civ, is to actually have it installed, you see.
Don't talk anymore.
Wow. Cardamando has never said anything like that to me.
You're not married to her.
And number 1 from episode 69. Though Civilization IV is specific in context, the case for and against settling a city one tile from the ocean remains prevalent in the series.
If you're that close to the coast, is it worth just moving one tile over and making it a coastal city or not? Because you can have the bonus of being near water in your BFC, and yet can't use, as second poster in the thread says, can't build a lighthouse, can't build a harbour, can't build ships. That you could presumably get hold of food resources from the water.
Well, I really think in, I'd say, 90% of situations, move to the coast. There's simply very few tactical situations that are going to make up in the long run for not having coastal resources, the lighthouse, the trade routes, etc., etc. It would be a very niche strategy that you would benefit from moving one tile inland just for, I don't know, defensive purposes.
Yeah, then you can prevent the transport attack.
Well, it could be a case of if you've got a couple of food resources on the coast and you've got, say, iron or something, just one tile in, so you have to go one tile in to get it in your fat cross, to get everything in your fat cross at once. There could possibly be that situation, but...
It could be, but I would probably build a second city just close and do it that way.
And another consideration also is that, yes, there might be some seafood resources on the coast, and you're settling inland because, towards the example Stuart was giving, so you could also have iron in your big fat cross, and that way you'll know you'll have it once your culture borders expand sufficiently. You could have another coastal city nearby, say, build a workboat, and then move that in to have that tile work. But yeah, it's a starting location issue. I think we've talked about this before, whether or not, oh, let's use this turn to move my settler to another tile, and moving to one tile over, like I'm moving into a forest or something, so that means I'm actually going to have to wait next turn to be able to do that. And I would say if you have to do that to get to the coast, don't do it. But if you're able to do it so that, like, if you're on a grasslands tile and you're moving over to another grasslands tile and that other grasslands tile happens to be the coast, that falls, I think, under the 90% of the time that you do want to be on the coast. I guess the only other consideration might be your map type. If you're playing islands, for instance, then depending upon how large the island is, you might be taking a gamble at, oh, well, I'll take the risk of not settling on the coast here in the hopes that once I explore the rest of the island, I'll find a decent city that can get access to the coast and still have sufficient hammers to be able to produce my naval units.
And number 1 from episode 64.
A standardized time. To what end?
What? What? No, no, come on.
That's funny.
Daylight savings time?
Ugh, don't remind me of ugh.
Oh, I know. You have discovered standardized time. Lose a turn.
What the fuck? That's awesome.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44, 121, 288, 7659. That's 44, 121, 288, Poly.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Thank you for listening to Polycast Evergreen Season 3. I'm Wouter Locutus Snijders. Your distinctiveness was added to my own.
Civilization 1 clips copyright MicroProse.
Civilization 4 sound clips copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.